If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with a New York State Certified seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
So this is Pauly Shore. I'm here in, is it Bushwick?
It's Bushwick.
Bushwick, and we're here at Roberto's. And Roberta's, and we're at, on Heritage Radio. We're talking about food. We're talking about, big glasses, and we're talking about all the man buns. And you're listening to The Morning After.
Episode 187 of The Morning After. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. I am coming to you live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm here in the studio, and my guest today is Andy Ricker. He's the chef and owner of the Pock Pock Empire that is in Portland and LA and New York. Hello, Andy.
Hi there. Greetings from Brooklyn, Portland. I'm actually in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn neighborhood of Portland right now.
Is there really much of a difference between Brooklyn and Portland anyway? I mean, we're basically the Portland of the West, and you're the Brooklyn of the, or the other way around. We're the Portland of the East, you're the Brooklyn of the West. Is that right?
Yeah, that's more or less correct, yeah.
Either way, we're basically all in the same time space, I think, according to Pauly Shore. I think that's what he would say.
Exactly, except you're sitting at Roberta's, and I'm sitting across the street from the Bear Paw Inn. A little different reality there.
How many man buns can you currently see right now?
There are zero man buns. Zero.
Okay, we are not in the same place.
Yeah.
David, am I allowed to use the Pauly Shore clip next season, or do I have to find someone new?
We'll talk off the air.
Okay, I'm currently auditioning a new Pauly Shore for next season. We start in January. I just want to put that out there.
A new Pauly Shore? Is that like a euphemism?
No. A rival Pauly Shore, I guess I'll say.
Oh, I see.
All right. I digress. Andy, we have some food news to share. If you wouldn't mind indulging me momentarily, I got to bring the news to the people. First off, in London, there was a naked pop-up restaurant. And that is apparently reopening for good.
Is that a pun? Naked pop-up?
Pop-up, huh?
No, but it should be. But it's actually real. It was a pop-up restaurant concept where everyone ate naked. And apparently it did so well, it's actually going to become a permanent restaurant. I don't know. London, they're just like, you know, you have this image of people over there across the pond being very sort of proper, but I got to tell you, that's pretty edgy, man. Would you dine
stiff
there, Andy?
Upper lip. and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Would you go?
Yeah. No. Now, wait a minute. Does it mean that you have to get naked to eat there? Or
yes, that's exactly what it... Naked? No, that's what it means. It means you have to be naked in order to eat there.
Yeah, I don't really eat naked, typically, unless I'm sitting in an ocean somewhere.
It sounds very dangerous, but apparently literally 45,000 people signed up to eat at the pop-up. Like, that's how many people wanted to do it. And I'm doubtful they could accommodate everyone, so they have to, like, now open up a permanent space so these 45,000 people can have their dreams come true, eating in a public space naked, which is definitely
fantastic.
My nightmare. All right, moving on. Let's see. Oh, okay. So Auntie Anne's, do you know, it's that pretzel place. Have you heard of this place? You know the place?
Not me.
Okay, this is like a place that's in every mall in America. They're known for these like very buttery pretzels that smell amazing. And they opened up in Malaysia. And they have a product that they're calling they call it the pretzel dog. That's what it's called here in the States. It's like a hot dog wrapped in a pretzel casing, which sounds, you know, pretty innocuous. But it's confusing Malaysians because they think it's dog that's wrapped in a pretzel. So,
oh, dear.
Yeah, I know. I was wondering if you've ever encountered anything like that in your travels abroad. Any sort of, I don't know, just like colloquial issues, like miscommunication.
Oh yeah, sure. But I've also encountered, like in Thailand, there's a pizza chain there that is actually an American pizza chain that I won't name, but they have one of their specials is a hot dog stuffed crust.
Yeah, exactly. So do people think it's a dog?
No, they don't think it's a dog. At this point in Thailand, hot dogs are actually, or some, you know, what they call hot dog is probably the most popular street food there is.
Hot dogs it's are the most popular street slime. Food in Thailand?
Yes.
What?
So it's pink slime in many different shapes and sizes. They either grill it or they deep fry it. But basically, anytime you walk down the street, there's somebody there selling what amounts to hot dog.
Huh. Weird.
Yep.
Okay.
It's not a hot dog in a bun. It's just
right.
like a... They're kind of a sausage on a stick type deal.
Oh, yeah, I guess I have seen that. Yeah. But it always, like, it just feels so other because you're there. Like, it never occurred to me that it's like, oh, it's a hot dog. Yeah. Anyway, in Malaysia, I guess Auntie Anne's is being asked to change the name from pretzel dog to pretzel sausage, like TM, so people are no longer confused. Okay, and then lastly...
Why don't they just call it pig in a blanket?
Because so much of the population is Muslim. Is the reason why.
There you go.
Yeah, like there's an actual reason because it has to be an all beef frank. Yep.
All right.
And in Ohio, my home state, a woman just stopped at a Wendy's, like one does, to pick up a snack for her 4-year-old child, got some fries. Her kids started complaining that her food was nasty, and she made her daughter spit out the fries, and she found a deep fried weed, a bunch of deep fried weed in the palm of her hand, and also what she thought was a blunt wrapper. And she
was. Get out of here.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think in some cases you'd be like pretty psyched to have a deep fried weed nugget creep up in your fries, but not if it's a 4-year-old. So,
well, in Oregon, where weed is legal, so that may actually become a reality here at some point. Weed nuggets.
That's a selling point.
Yeah.
That's something that people would use for marketing purposes, but not in Ohio.
Why not?
Not yet.
Yeah.
And especially not the blunt wrapper. Like, I think even in Oregon, they'd be like, I'm good. I don't need the blunt wrapper to actually be part of the food.
Yeah, nobody needs to eat a blunt wrapper.
No one.
When I was a kid, we used to challenge each other to eat the roach. So, you know, there is a history of eating the blunt wrapper. But
not because it tastes good.
No, it's on a dare.
No, nobody wants that. All right. Well, that's funny. All right, cool. That's our food news for the day. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back to talk with Andy Ricker of Pock Pock.
New York chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
We're back. You're listening to The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. I'm here with Andy Ricker. He is the chef and restaurateur of Pock Pock Restaurants in Portland, New York, and L.A. He is a 2-time winner of the James Beard Award. His first cookbook, Pock Pock, Food and Stories from the Streets, Homes, and Roadside Restaurants of Thailand, was published in 2013 by 10 Speed Press. Welcome to The Morning After, Andy Ricker.
Thank you very much.
Welcome again.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're in Portland, where the original Pock Pock opened. And now you have locations in New York and L.A., which is most recent. Yeah.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. How are they all different? And how do the cities that they're in, like, affect the personalities of each of the locations?
Well, for the most part, they're all Pock Pock. So they all share sort of a commonality, and often they share the majority of the menu items. They are different in that the spaces that they're in are different in the different cities, and then the market that we're in is different. So I guess the easiest way to kind of think about the differences are what's available in the different markets, so that it affects the menu, right? So in New York, we actually have this great pipeline of produce that comes up from Florida. So some very great Thai, Southeast Asian produce can make it up during the summertime. And in Portland, we're kind of, we're in between. Like in L.A., there's a great source for products. And in Vancouver, B.C., there's a great source. But we're kind of in the middle. So we're on the truck route. We get the stuff that comes from L.A., and we have to fly some stuff in from Hawaii. So it kind of changes a little bit what we're able to do on the menu. The other way that they're different is that, as I said, the markets. So in New York, for instance, we tend to sell a lot more of the sort of more esoteric Northern Thai dishes than we do in Portland. Portland, we tend to sell a lot more of the more populist type stuff, like the chicken wings and the roasted chicken and ribs and stuff like that. And in L.A., where we have a market that's very used to eating Southeast Asian and Asian food for decades now, we tend to sell things like steamed fish, which is a hard sell in both New York and Portland. We sell the heck out of it in L.A. just because people are kind of used to that stuff. So they all have their own little personality quirks, but essentially they're all pock-pock.
Is that because people are a little more health conscious also in L.A.?
I don't think so. Like where we are anyway, L.A., you know, like New York has, neighborhoods are different from one another there, what people eat, where they go, what they do. L.A. is kind of the same deal. So we're on downtown, we're in Chinatown. And the demographic down there is different than it is on the west side. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in the west side of L.A., that's where you're likely to run into people who want the egg white omelet and, you know, the fat-free this and, the, mm-hmm. you know, the kale salad. And on the west side, people are, they're not focused on that as much. They're more focused on strong flavors, lots of protein. So it's a different, it's not, you know, it doesn't quite fit that L.A. Cliche.
Sure, right? Yeah, the way New Yorkers
the reason why they order more steamed fish is because the demographic is different. It's a lot of young folks, a lot of Asian folks that come in to eat. They've been, you know, like I said, L.A. has a decades-long history of, Southeast Asian and Chinese food being and Korean food being very much part of the culture. And so people are just used to eating steamed fish.
Yeah. How were you first received in L.A. since there is such a strong history of Thai food in that area?
Oh, yeah. Well, I can't say it was all positive. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, to a certain amount of people are just like, how dare you come here? We already have, you know, we've got the best Thai food in the country. We've got, you know, some of the best Thai food in the world. And, you know, they've got an argument. They've had Thai food there for, you know, 40 some odd years. So, you know, there's a lot of skepticism and, to be honest, some folks just really didn't want us around. But there's also been a fair amount of people who are happy that we're there, who've come up to eat in Portland or in New York. So, you know, it's been a mixed bag, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It hasn't all been great.
I read the Jonathan Gold review, and he did admit to going in kind of skeptical, but it did sound like even after the first bite, he was won over. So that must have been really helpful to have that review come out.
It was. I mean, it's been very interesting. I think that, we've generally received really good reviews from the critics. But they too are, you know, they're Angelenos, and they have a very specific connection with their city. And, as I think Jonathan Gold said, it is a white guy doing Thai food. There's a lot to unpack there. So, you know, at the end of the review, you read it, and it's like, well, that was a positive review. But I don't think that either he or the other folks who reviewed were able to just look at it and view it outside of the context of L.A. And that's the nature of the game.
Yeah,
you're always
certainly,
judged on the context of the market you're in.
Sure. I mean, especially because he's such a champion of like true ethnic cuisine that exists. But I do want to unpack that like in a little bit because there's a lot to talk about there. But just in terms of like your history and like you getting started with Thai food, I read about how you kind of went to Thailand with no intention of ever opening a restaurant necessarily. What was the most surprising and compelling thing that you discovered about the food that clearly changed your life trajectory?
Well, I mean, we're talking
like 1988,
old ancient history now. Yeah. So, you know, I went there for the first time in the mid 80s, and that trip wasn't really about food, but I did experience the food there. And what I noticed was right away, was that even though I was ordering at bungalows, eating at bungalows and tourist places, because in backpacker places, is that even dishes that I recognized from home, like green curry and whatnot, just didn't taste the same as I'd remembered it in the States. So that was the first thing I noticed. And then going back again to the early 90s, 1992 to be exact, I had an experience eating a specific Northern Thai dish that was seasonal, local, and regional. And it, you know, it just triggered the realization that Thai food, like any great cuisine, is seasonal, it's local, it's regional, and that applies to the entire country. So just knowing that there was this cuisine that you could only see there because of the time and place, that you won't see outside of the country. That basically is what hooked me and made me look deeper.
Why has Northern Thai cuisine, as opposed to Central or Southern, do you think resonated with you more or like manifested more in your cooking?
Well, you know, I think that the main reason was just time and place. That's where I happened to be. If I'd have had a similar experience in the south of Thailand, Pok Pok may have been a Southern Thai restaurant. But it so happens that, you know, Chiang Mai and the area around there is the place in Thailand that I initially went to, that I ended up spending the most time in, where I was introduced to this stuff. I got taught how to make lob by my friend's, father-in-law, an elderly Northern Thai guy. And that was, I was so fascinated by that dish, and it's so delicious and so interesting that it just kind of sucked me in really hard. So I don't know. I do think that all the regions have really interesting, fantastic dishes, but for whatever reason, it's the Northern Thai that's kind of stuck with me the most.
Mm-hmm. I think at this point, you know, anyone who's interested in food sees you as like this incredible resource and authority, not only on like turning people on in the West about like what Thai food actually tastes like in Thailand, but also like people who, you know, want to go to Thailand and travel, and like now they can turn to you or like your Instagram or, you know, other articles and actually go to these specific places. Does that ever concern you? Like, do you ever feel like you want to protect these places, even though at the same time you've become like an authority or like a resource and telling people where to go? I mean, do you ever feel conflicted about it?
The only conflict that I would feel about that is that, it would be a selfish one in that I don't, you know, it's possible that if too many foreigners go there that the food will be altered. Yeah. But look, I mean, people who are selling food for a living in Thailand, they're selling it for a living. And, I feel like if I'm able to bring them more business, that is literally one of the only real ways that I have of kind of giving back to this culture and to the people who have taught me stuff. You know, you can give somebody, you know, a couple thousand baht for a recipe, or you can put them on your Instagram account, and as long as they're open, a ton of people will come through there and buy food from them. So, and then tell their friends. So I think that it wouldn't be a good thing if I was just to keep quiet about the places that I thought were really good there.
Right.
Also, I want to encourage those people to keep on doing what they're doing, and also to kind of help the by sending people to places like Hun Him Tong, way out in the middle of nowhere in Maon, and having this fantastic food. It kind of shows those folks that foreigners can eat local food and are happy to eat the local food. And it changes attitudes about what Thai people are willing to serve to foreigners in some small way, I think. Very small way. Yeah.
I was in Thailand a couple of months ago. I only went to Bangkok, but I was so surprised to see how many Western fast food chains had infiltrated, like, since the time I had gone, which is about 10 years before, like, Kentucky Fried Chickens. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's like it is this weird duality where it's like it's so positive to have this very, you know, all this fluidity with tourism now and like the age of Airbnb and like Uber and anyone can go to Asia. But I don't know. There's also this thing about globalization that's like so cringy. And so I guess that's sort of what I was trying to tap into. Like on one end, like it's fantastic if it's only improving local people's business. But at the other time, at the other, you know, the other coin, flip of the coin is like you want to preserve the integrity of like what Thai culture is. And I worry about too many people coming over there.
Look, I think that you know, the thing is that Thailand is not a third world country mm-hmm. at this point. It's you know, it's moving out of the category of developing country even. I mean, they've got Hello Kitty and super malls there, you know, giant. It's not a backwoods place being ruined. It is full participation in the modern world. And there's a growing middle class and, you know, they're just as aware of what's going on in the country. They're just as obsessed with fast food stuff as we are. And it's not entirely on Western travelers coming through. If you go to McDonald's there, yeah, you'll see Western travelers if you're in an area where there's a lot of Western travelers. But, you know, the predominant market there are Thai people, young Thai kids. They love fast food. And there's another thing to keep in mind, too, is that Thailand has a long history of franchises and fast food. If you go down the street and you see a noodle stand and you stop by, the chances are that this is not a mom-and-pop shop that's been, you know, that has their own original recipe that's been doing it for 50 years. Usually those people are in a shop front somewhere. The food carts in like, I would say a huge portion of them are actually franchises, but you wouldn't know unless you could read Thai and you understood, right?
Yeah.
So it's really surprising how many like noodle carts in Thailand are actually franchises, like the way a McDonald's is a franchise.
Oh yeah, that's funny. That would have never occurred to me.
And owned by you know CP, which is this massive food conglomerate there that's comparable to other giant food conglomerates in the United States. You know, there's a perception in the West. We would like to go to Thailand and think that we're in this sort of magical kingdom of tradition and, you know, all this stuff. But look, it's a rapidly changing. It always has been a rapidly changing place where traditions come and, you know, modify themselves, change, you know, some of it's preserved, some of it isn't. So, you know, it's a complicated situation there. It's not as simple as, you know, there's traditional food that, and then there's this fast food coming in and taking over. It's much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm, of course. All right. So switching gears a little bit back to what's going on with you in L.A., I read about how you tried to implement a 5% service charge when the restaurants first opened in L.A. to kind of balance or to supplement the wages of the back of the house so that things are a little bit more equitable between the cooks and the servers, but it didn't work. Have things stabilized? Are there any plans to bring the service charge back?
No. At the moment, everybody in the industry who you talk to is, this is the number one thing we're all thinking about and trying to figure out what to do. This is a conversation that could go for hours, but essentially, you know, the tipping model is broken. It's not going to last forever. We're going to have to do something. There's a bunch of different ways you can do it. You could institute a service charge. You could go to only a service charge where there's a flat, you know, service charge in certain areas. You can't do that by law. Another possibility is putting a kitchen tip line on the guest check so people can go ahead and tip the kitchen directly if they want. But the problem is that, or you could just raise prices until it works. But the problem is that there's the dining public, and they don't like service charges. They don't like a lot of places, unless it's a very high-end place or a McDonald's. They don't like the no tipping model. People love tipping. Customers love tipping. Owners love tipping because it subsidizes their business to the tune of close to 20% of all revenue. And the people who receive tips love it because they get a ton of money for doing, you know, a relatively small amount of work on a daily basis, hours-wise. So it's a really tough nut to crack, but it's something that we're all going to have to do, because when the minimum wage hits $15 an hour and in New York they eliminate the tip credit, which will most likely happen at some point, we're in a situation where the front of the house is getting $15 an hour, plus they're getting 20% tips on a check that in New York City, as you know, can run, you know, right now runs close to $100 per person. You know, and when the restaurant raises prices high enough to cover what wages will have to be in the back of the house to make things more equitable, you know, you can see where this goes.
Of course, yeah.
It's a very difficult thing to figure out.
It's a really difficult thing. And you know, the result is that it's really, really hard to get cooks in the door and keep them there. And that's the cook shortage problem is everywhere. It's not just in LA. It's in New York. It's everywhere.
It's global.
It's global, yeah.
It's not just in America.
Yeah. How are you dealing with this? What are you doing to attract talented cooks?
You know, the best thing we can do is just pay, you know, market rate or above, and provide a good structured work environment where, you know, people want to work. I mean, I guess that's, of course, we're big enough that you know, we offer health care. There's other things that have come down the pike that have made it easier, like sick leave and stuff like that. But honestly, it's a very, very hard nut to crack. If you are a young person who's looking for a job and you know that your entry wage into a kitchen is going to be $13-14 an hour, or you could go and be a busboy or you know, support staff entry level, and you're going to be making double that, you know. It's really hard to justify going and working in a hot, sweaty, dirty kitchen. You know, you have to really be dedicated to it. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I don't know what the answer is, honestly. As I said before, I think the tipping system is broken. We've got to find a way to bring the wages up in the back of the house. And, you know, the average person says, well, why don't you just pay them more? Why don't you just pay them more? But the problem is that restaurants run on a very slim profit margin, you know. 7 to 10% is good. A lot of places run on 5%, 3% profit margin. And, you know, that's not a very big margin to run a successful business on.
Yeah.
So, you know, simply just paying more isn't the answer. Well, we have to pay more, but we also have to charge more. And unfortunately, the way that food works in America, there's statistics saying that we spend less on food percentage-wise than almost any other major Western market. So we don't value food the same way a lot of the rest of the world does, and we'll have to start doing that too.
Well, I'm sure that it's even more difficult for you because you run Thai restaurants. And I know, you know, a lot of the perception, at least in the Western world, is that ethnic food is cheap food. And, you know, you've done a lot to help kind of dispel those stereotypes because of the quality of food that you use. Is it getting better? I mean, are people kind of letting go of this notion that ethnic food means cheap food now that we have so many different chefs out there cooking kind of elevated ethnic cuisine?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent progress is made all the time. And, you know, it's going to be a struggle for a long time. The people who are the type of people who might listen to this show are already aware of this stuff. And the folks who, you know, read Eater or Grub Street, or they're already mostly aware of this. It's the general public that just doesn't, you know, that they don't really have any resources to kind of point out why, you know, you should pay $4 for a taco if the person is using good quality meat and they're paying their wages and their taxes and all that kind of stuff. You know, how do you educate people about that? That's a really difficult thing to do. So it's going to be a problem for a long time. And, you know, I don't know exactly what to do to get people to come around to it, other than just keep on putting your head down and doing what you think is right, as long as you can do it, as long as it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. How have you seen American palates changed, or maybe you haven't since you first opened Pak Pak in 2005.
Right. So, you know, we're coming up on 11 years of being open. And I think the most obvious thing is the demographics of America, especially in the markets that we operate in, have changed. So it's become a lot more ethnically diverse. The people who are coming to the restaurants are much more aware. They're, you know, maybe their cultural background is in Southeast Asia or East Asia or middle, you know, Central America. They were kids that maybe grew up with other kids from other cultures, and so they're just much more aware. So I think that's the biggest change. Also, the other thing is the rise of food entertainment over the last 10 years. Like when I popped open the doors, you know, Food Network was just starting out. I think probably there wasn't, you know, food entertainment wasn't anything like it is now. And we've got a population that's been raised on, you know, Food Network, Travel Channel, all that kind of stuff. It's part of our national psyche at this point. So people have seen things, and they're a lot more adventurous these days. I would say that's the positive effect of food entertainment.
But that's a big positive. I mean, especially when, you know, like to the point that we were just talking about, like trying to convince people that just because your food is Thai food doesn't mean it's not of a certain quality and not of a certain price point.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I agree. There's a lot of things to be said negatively about food entertainment, about, you know, making, you know, especially people are looking at getting into the food industry, it skews their kind of perception of what it means to be a cook or a server. And it skews the perception of what the folks come to eat can expect. But it also has opened the doors to, you know, when Andrew Zimmern goes and eats in Koreatown and writes about it and says how amazing it is, you know, he gets people fired up to go out and try to eat live octopus. And that's kind of amazing.
It is, yeah. So you have a cookbook, which is wonderful. And I've heard that you have two more on the way.
yeah.
But, you know, it's real Thai food. And so what do you say to someone who has your book maybe but still feels really intimidated about how to cook these recipes, you know, asking for a friend?
I would say start with something simple. I mean, a lot of the food on the surface, when you crack that book and you look at the recipe, you're like, wow, this is really intense. Excuse me. But once you sort of build up the pantry and a couple of simple tools and kind of dig into it, you'll see that it's actually, once you gather all the mise en place and prepare everything, the actual assembly of the food is really quick and easy. So I would say start with something simple. Learn how to cook rice. That's the first thing in the book, is learn how to cook rice correctly, because that's the basis of the cuisine. The next thing I would say would be to try something simple, and there's one recipe I'll point people towards, and that's the fried egg salad, yum kai dao. It's something that's damn easy to execute. You only need a few things that it will be outside of your typical pantry. Most of it you can buy at like a, you know, Whole Foods or something like that, or Safeway at this point. You can get fish sauce at Safeway these days. So, you know, fish sauce, palm sugar, and Thai chilies. You know, those are the only things in there that are really kind of outside of what we normally would have access to. So I'd say start with that. Now, the good thing about learning how to do yum kai dao is that same basic recipe can be applied to a bunch of different stuff. You could do grilled pork in that instead, or squid, and you know, it's just a slight change of ratios. So you learn a whole category that way.
Where do you shop in New York, when other than, you know, the Whole Foods, which you mentioned?
Well, I'm lucky enough to live in Sunset Park in Brooklyn. I've lived there for the last few years. And, of course, we have Fei Long, which is a great supermarket there. You can get a lot of stuff. There's a bunch of other supermarkets around there. You can get the R train that goes all the way? I think so. You can go to the R train to 8th Avenue, and Fei Long's just, you know, very close to there. That's a great place. If you're in Manhattan, you can go to, in Chinatown, there is the Bangkok what is it called? Bangkok City Market, I think it's called.
Okay.
Right in the middle of Chinatown. Hmm. Really small shop. They've got all the basic pantry items that you need are there. Plus, they get some specialty produce and herbs and that sort of thing from the same guy who supplies us from his farms in Florida.
I have to ask, because when I was in Thailand, I tried to bring back Thai whiskey, but it got taken away from me at the airport, and I wasn't allowed to travel with it. Something about, like, connecting through Taiwan, like, you can't bring whiskey through Taiwan. I don't know. But I haven't been able to find it. Does that exist here in New York?
Which one? Mekong?
Yeah, I guess. Or, like, really, I mean, any of it.
Yeah. Yeah, you can get Mekong in America. You can just buy it from a typical distributor or liquor store. They might not carry. You might have to request it. But Mekong is available in the United States. We get it in New York. We get it in Portland. We get it in L.A. So it's totally available.
Cool. And you have a book coming out on Thai drinking culture. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
And you have one more.
And then there'll be a noodle book after that a year later.
Okay. Cool. So when can we look out for those?
I believe we are set for fall 2017 for the drinking food book, and I believe it's fall 2018 for the noodle, but don't hold me to that on the noodle book.
Okay. All right. Well, that's very exciting. We're going to take a quick break. Andy, stay with us because we're going to be back with the morning after quiz.
Sure.
Thanks. And we're back. It's time for the morning after quiz with my guest, Andy Ricker. So it's going to be three questions, Andy, and each question has three multiple choice possibilities. And it's always something, you know, that you really shouldn't have too much knowledge about, but is related to something that you do actually know. So I know, because I follow you on Instagram, that you are a big fan of cats.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You have
That's true.
Three cats, three Siamese cats.
Yeah, three cats. Two Siamese and one tabby.
Okay, so I know you know a lot about your cats, but I don't know how much you know about the Broadway musical Cats.
Nothing.
Good. Okay. Nothing. Because this quiz was probably not going to be very successful on my end if you knew a lot about the Broadway musical Cats. Oh my God, that's terrifying. Stop that right now. Okay, so this is a quiz on the Broadway musical Cats. Like, stop. Okay, so first question. What is the plot of the Broadway musical Cats? A, Cats is about a group of thespian cats who have started a theater company and spend their evening practicing their musical numbers. They are waiting for their cat leader, Deuteronomy, to judge their performance and determine which cat has the most talent. Or is it B, Cats tells the story of a young immigrant cat, Boris von Wiskowitz, who is accidentally separated from his family in New York. He falls in with a group of ethnically diverse cats living in an alleyway, all trying to work together to make new lives for themselves in America. Or is it C? Cats is about a tribe of cats called the Jellicles, and the night they make what is known as the Jellicle Choice and decide which cat will ascend to the Heaviside Lair and come back to a new life.
Oh, brother. I have, you know what, this is so bad, but I've lived in New York for about 7 years now. I've never gone to a Broadway show ever.
Not one?
Not one single Broadway. It's pathetic.
Well, you've been busy. You have a good excuse.
Yeah, this is going to suck. How about B?
B is not the right answer. B is the story of a young immigrant cat. I loosely based B on that movie, An American Tale. Have you ever seen that?
Oh.
The cartoon one about the mouse?
Nope.
Well, okay. Well, I'm glad I'm giving all sorts of cultural references that mean nothing to you today.
Yeah, I'm not.
But that's okay. This is literally the most meaningless quiz of your life, so it's all good. Okay. Which of the following is not a cat in Cats? A, Griddlebone, B, Rumpeltigger, or C, Mungo Jerry?
Jesus. A?
Griddlebone is, in fact, a cat in Cats. Rumpeltigger B.
Can you just choose the next one randomly for me? Like, just...
I could.
It's so bad.
No, you're really... This is perfect. Like, this is exactly what I hope for. Like, for you not to know any of the answers.
Awesome.
Yep. All right. Okay, so C, there's actually a revival of Cats now playing on Broadway. So, Andy, next time you're in New York, you could go see it. Which song was cut and is no longer a part of the current show? Oh. Is it A, Growl Tiger's Last Stand, B, The Battle of the Peaks and the Policies, Part 1, or C, Gus the Theater Cat?
B?
No, that's a real song. Or that's still in it. The Battle of the Peaks and Policies, Part 1 and Part 2 is still in it. They cut Growl Tiger's Last Stand, which is a song about a pirate cat who at some point has this like weird flashback about doing battle with Siamese cats. And this one, you know, I thought about you especially. They took it out because there's this like vaguely racist portion where the Siamese cats use these like generic Asian-y accents. And finally people were like,
oh, dear.
Can you just not do that? Because it's kind of racist. So they took that one out.
Oh, brother.
I know, right? So now you should be really excited to go see it next time you're in New York. Or not, because now you know everything you need to know.
except for I can't remember anything you just told me. So
I'll be sure to send you all the notes.
Yeah.
All right, Andy, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Morning After. It was really cool to talk to you. And any more Pock-Pocks coming our way, or are we good for now with the three cities?
We're actually opening a new spot here in Portland. I don't know if you recall, but when we first opened in New York, we opened Pock-Pock Wing on the Lower East Side.
Mm-hmm.
We are actually opening a version of that in Portland right now in a location right next to our commissary in a building that used to be a Tasty Freeze years ago. So that's opening this week. That's actually why, you know, I'm hammering away trying to get that up and rolling.
Okay, cool.
That's our newest addition.
Well, congrats on that.
And thanks.
Next time I'm in Portland, I'll be sure to check that out. I'll just have to deal with being in the Portland of the East in Brooklyn.
There it is.
All right. Thanks for being our guest. Thanks, everyone, for listening to The Morning After. See you same time, same place, Sundays at 3 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.